Listeners like you make living on Earth possible each week. Please contribute today by clicking on the donate link to the left of the page. And thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. And we're back in Cameroon and the Congo Basin, where reporter Alex Chadwick is trying to get to a small village beside a great forest, a place that may be a factor in the climate change equation.
The ferry barge that links the village of Anguilla to the outside world is on the opposite bank and in no hurry to come get us. Time passes. River flies cluster on ankles and feet. Other waiting travelers begin dabbing gasoline on bare skin. It's better than getting bitten. At last, the ferry barge pushes off from the other shore and begins its slow passage. No one bothers us for a permit.
Maybe you can start to hear the water flowing past the stern of the ferry. It's on its way across the river. It's a square floating platform, maybe 30 feet by 30 feet. It's attached to a cable that runs from shore to shore, probably 20 feet up in the air. It's got two cables from the ferry run to the long stretcher cable. And that's what keeps the ferry in operation. The river here is about 100 yards across, and it flows very quickly.
A ferry boat driven by current is not simply a means to cross open water. It conveys you into the past at the pace of life in a village. An outsider adjusts to this bucolic relic.
Now, this road we're on, it passes clusters of mud brick homes, fields of papaya, plantains, and cassava. There aren't many people until Anguilla.
The village at the edge of the forest. This is rural, but it's more active than any place we've seen for hours. Some people have generators for power, so there's this composition of mud brick, corrugated roof, and satellite dish. And young men pass by buzzing on motorbikes.
I am the district officer. My name is Obate Ankon Joseph.
Now, Anguilla has a mayor, but this guy, the district officer, he's the real big shot. The government owns the forest in Cameroon, and he's the government's man.
Those who are living here, everything they eat, everything they do, medical care, of course, is coming from the forest. The forest is then very, very important for the people who are living here. It is also the forest that gives land for the people to have their farm, for people to farm. Everything here is coming from the forest.
Christopher's been over talking to the mayor. What did he say?
His name is Bamtal Alphonse. He's one of the town's few elected officials. He told me a little bit about Anguilla. He said there are about 6,000 people here, two major ethnic groups, the Jim and the Baka. And if you walk around town, you see a lot of people carrying machetes, men and boys. And the mayor told me that they use those machetes to hack out their living. They grow plantains, cocoa, and bananas. Anguilla's number one problem? Poverty. This town is desperate for electricity, for running water, for cell phones, and for more teachers. And Mayor Alphonse says, if carbon is the answer to Anguilla's problems, let's make a deal, and fast.
You know, as we've come along down the road from the main capital, 6,000 people is actually a pretty substantial community for at least this region of Cameroon. We see there are other dirt roads leading off from here. There's a little church over there.
Lots of chickens.
Yeah, yard chickens. And we're going to go see the women's group?
Yeah, let's go. They're right down the road here.
Au profit de sa brousse, de sa forêt, au profit de sa forêt, nous voulons l'électrification de la ville.
Madame Mawol Jacquet.
Du téléphone.
Invites us into her home, the front room, a large space, comfortable with almost 20 ladies from the Anguilla Women's Association, each in an elegant print dress, many with a matching head wrap. I wish I had a clean shirt.
La création des emplois.
You don't need French to get it that Madame Jacquet is unhappy with the state of events here. Anguilla needs phones, electricity, schools.
Manque des enseignants, manque même d'école.
And she told us she has 10 children. 8 of her kids have been away to school and they've come back home. None of them can find a job in Anguilla.
We spend 4 days in Anguilla. The nearby forest is what Mike Korchinski promised. The Anguilla Mintum Conservation Area is about 3,000 square miles, so vast it's like looking at the ocean. The trees are densely packed and enormous carbon columns. We interview farmers and foresters and confirm what the officials tell us. This place is poor. And if the villagers can't exploit the forest, it's going to stay that way. It's just too remote. There's nothing else to develop. A farmer's market opens at dawn on a Saturday in an area by the drooping town pavilion. 4 vendors offer a few wretched samples of local goods. A small boy has several yams on the bare earth. In half an hour, the dozen browsers who had come by are gone, and the vendors are quitting too. On the ferry, returning to the capital for an important interview, I'm mashing UN climate policy and carbon wealth and life in a forest village. Here are some of the parts. In Cameroon, trees are plentiful and money is scarce. Timber is the number 2 export. It was a real sacrifice to set aside Anguilla Mintum for conservation. Cameroon expected some green eco-development money for communities like a timber company would offer, but the conservation money never came. Finally, officials moved to open this conservation forest to loggers, but RED was just then emerging as the favored policy option of climate negotiators, and the global recession was devaluing timber prices.
And so, in the months that followed, our California investor, Mike Korchinski, came to Yaoundé with his RED bid. South African investors made another RED offer. And the World Bank and the World Wildlife Fund are working together on a RED proposal.
And suddenly, Cameroon is rethinking what to do again.
My name is Elvis Ngole Ngole. I am the Minister of Forestry and Wildlife, meaning I'm in charge of all the trees and the wildlife.
Elvis Ngole Ngole, married to an American, studied in the U.S. for 11 years, used to listen to public radio.
And maybe that's why he personally waived the $2,000 fee that someone wanted to charge us for recording in the forest. Elvis is the person who decides what happens with the forests of Cameroon and RED.
If the people see that their conditions of living are improving in terms of education, health, in terms of infrastructure development, in terms of opportunities for employment, I think that they will know that the efforts are meaningful to them and are relevant to them.
Are you at all concerned that this is another form of selling off a part of Africa to other people to use to solve their problems?
Africa has come of age. Africa has come out of its, I don't want to say, grudge against colonialism. I think that Africans have grown up to the point where they believe in looking forward and not looking backwards. I think the history of colonialism and colonial exploitation is there, but it's looked upon by the present generation of African leaders as, well, that is an original sin, but we must go ahead, we must continue, and not to worry about those who want to exploit you and exploit you to extinction.
The Ministry of Forest and Wildlife has done well managing timber exports, but it's nothing compared to what a RED carbon market might bring. I worked through one investment prospectus. It projects a carbon value for Anguilla Mintum of more than $7 billion.
Now, Alex, you know, officials never want to discuss numbers in public. But Minister Ngole Ngole didn't disagree with the figure you gave him, except that maybe it isn't high enough.
You've used the figure of $7 billion. I've heard of figures way more than that. I think the Nedbank, South African Nedbank, came here the other day and talked in terms of hundreds, I think it was somewhere around 200 billion. I think that if it's 7 billion, then that's fine. But if it's more than 7 million, then why not? The people will be more than happy if they can be told that the best value for that pristine forest is more than they ever imagined. I think that would be great. On the entire continent of Africa, the Congo Basin Forest is the only remaining contiguous forest massive that's remaining, and that has value for the fight against climate change. And whatever we can derive in terms of carbon credits is the Congo Basin Forest Massive. So there is a huge economic value in ensuring that that forest remains intact.
Red, the Congo Basin Forest, money. We're leaving Cameroon for elsewhere in the Congo Basin, but I've got this flashback to the Anguilla Forest and our town and our encounter with Madame Mowolchaket. She doesn't romanticize Anguilla's rustic river ferry as I did. Now I realize she hates it. It's a symbol, sure, but not of an earlier, more authentic human spirit. To Anguilla, the ferry means impotence and isolation.
And if red and carbon policy and climate change get her a bridge, she's all for it. But if the timber companies can do it, that's okay too.
The Minister of Forests and Wildlife, Mr. Ngole Ngole, told us he's never been to Anguilla. He's waiting to go, he says, until he has something to tell them. Soon, he hopes. But I would guess he already knows about Madame Jacquet and what she's expecting, what he and Red are going to have to deliver. But when?
Whatever happens in Cameroon, the real big question of the Congo Basin Forest is going to be decided here. This is the Democratic Republic of Congo and the city of Kinshasa. The Congo Basin is enormous, a huge amount of forest, but almost all of it is in this country.
Kinshasa calls itself the largest French-speaking city in the world, 7.5 million people.
If you count Paris's whole metro area, it has more.
But Paris doesn't lie a few degrees south of the equator, hot and rainy, busy, poor, dangerous to walk around.
Not as dangerous as Eastern Congo, site of what's called Africa's World War. The numbers vary. 4 million dead, 5 million dead, a 20-year conflict that still runs like a low-grade fever. Neighbor armies, militias, outsiders with greed and guns come to kill, rape, and loot.
Congo is too rich in resources, minerals, gold, timber, for the outsiders to leave. Congo's too poor in civil development, maybe too corrupt, to drive them out. An actual government has been slowly reasserting itself in the last few years, but maybe it's more an experiment than a process.
One healthy sign? Many international aid agencies are no longer too scared to work here. Another, there is money coming in. The Chinese are here very eagerly.
We went to see a man named John Flynn. He's an American. He works for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and he runs a program called the Central African Regional Program for the Environment. They fund a lot of green conservation projects. They're trying to figure out how to conserve the forest, how to manage the forest, how to keep the wildlife.
What would you say the rate of deforestation is in the Congo Basin?
The rate of deforestation from at least 1990 to 2000 is about 1.5% of the total canopy, and that's less than 0.15% per year.
Isn't that fairly low rate of deforestation?
It's by far the lowest in any forested region of the world, including even the temperate forest. Really, the principal cause of deforestation is small-scale farming. This is very small-scale, of small-scale villagers, and people harvesting wood for fuel, for charcoal and firewood.
This is key to understanding carbon and the Congo Basin. A lot of people cut a little forest for small farms, but there's hardly any commercial use, no logging. There's no big local market for timber, and it costs too much to get logs out of here to sell internationally. The forest is not being cut, which is the good news. Also, in some way, the bad news.
First, the good. We're back with the American John Flynn, who works for USAID, which funds the Central African Regional Program for the Environment, CARPE.
Is it an irony that the Democratic Republic of Congo has been ignored, that now, suddenly, it has potentially an enormous resource?
Not only an enormous resource, but it puts the Congo on the world stage in a way it hasn't really been in a positive way in its entire history. And these are critical days ahead of us, ahead of this region, ahead of this country, ahead of maybe the entire humanity, if I could be a little dramatic, because what's decided here and how things work over the next few years may well determine the future of our planet.
I made some notes over conversations I've had with you for the last couple of days. I went back and looked at them. You told me the danger of red is that it will provide disincentives.
Anytime you have a massive shift of the ground, it creates a lot of distortions in the system that's not ready for all of this attention yet. And one of my concerns has been that Central Africa needs time to get ready for this system, whatever it might be.
Remember the not cutting the forest equals bad news flag from a moment ago? Here's how a history of benign forestry could be bad for Congo.
Your world fundamental goal is cut ongoing carbon emissions. Your red method is pay to reduce deforestation. So, look, Brazil cuts a lot of trees. It qualifies for big payments that actually will affect emissions in the atmosphere, which is what you want. And Congo cuts very few trees, so it qualifies for what?
UN climate negotiators have been debating this for a while and more or less conclude that paying Brazil for bad behavior and ignoring Congo's good behavior makes no sense. They're working on it.
Something like this, we have to be thinking very long term.
John Flynn, the USAID man in Kinshasa.
We're not used to thinking long term in the United States, and we're certainly not thinking long term most of the time in Africa. So it's ushering in a whole new way of doing business, a whole new kind of light on this region that's been kind of shrouded. And I think it's going to be a positive thing, but we have to be careful.
That's John Flynn, a USAID official working in Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo. If he's right about our human aversion to long-term thinking, and climate is all long-term, maybe nothing happens until climate becomes crisis.
This is a special report on Red and the Congo Basin from Alex Chadwick. Our story on how climate change policy could work in the world's second largest tropical forest continues in a minute. Stay tuned to Living on Earth.
Support for the Environmental Health Desk at Living on Earth comes from the Cedar Tree Foundation. Support also comes from the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund for coverage of population and the environment, and from Gilman Ordway for coverage of conservation and environmental change. This is Living on Earth on PRI, Public Radio International.